Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lola Reed, professor in UNC's Department of Cell Molecular Physiology, about stem cell research.
Interesting and controversial topic. Sometimes.
Yeah, maybe it's controversial. You know, I realize kind of like I don't know as much as I'd like to know about stem cell research.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to finding out more. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters, Adam.
About common things like weight loss surgery.
About sitting, linking to having shorter lives.
Lung cancer and ways of perhaps increasing survival.
And insurance tied to ER visits. We'll talk
emergency
more about
room.
What that means. Yeah.
We'll have to get your opinion on that, given that you are married to an emergency room doctor.
I will have plenty of opinions, I'm sure. First, we're going to talk about surgery for weight loss, cutting blood sugar more than medicines.
Yes. We've talked about, and we had on one of the bariatric surgeons at the UNC's gastrointestinal surgery about bariatric surgery a few months ago, Christy. And this is new research in the New England Journal of Medicine on this very topic.
Yeah, this was a study conducted at the Cleveland Clinic finding that patients who underwent surgery for obesity were more than three times more likely to gain control over their diabetes and real control, meaning an A1C less than six.
Yeah, that three-month average blood sugar test.
Yeah, much more significant to get that than the people who were treated with just medicines alone.
Yeah, this is really amazing. You know, we've been talking about the increasing amount of good research that looks at bariatric surgery or the two different types of surgery for weight loss and possible benefits. And we've known that it can help diabetes. But this suggests that for a lot of patients, obese patients, it might actually cure their diabetes because they lose so much weight.
So the study was called Stampede, and the researchers assigned...
Stampede?
I know, it stands for something. But they randomly assigned 150 patients. Three quarters of them were female, and another quarter was male. And the body mass index on average was between 27 and 43. And they divided them into three different groups.
Right, and they found that those who... underwent this gastric bypass surgery, 42% of them achieved this hemoglobin A1C of control compared to only 12% of the patients that were getting the drug only, kind of the best standard approach to treating their diabetes.
And they also did a different surgery approach with the sleeve gastrectomy, which sort of makes the stomach smaller, and 37% of those had the good control. So whichever way you had surgery to reduce weight dramatically, that had a much more profound effect on that blood sugar level than diet, I mean, than medicine alone.
Right. And so there's some take-home messages here, because not only did it, you know, improve their diabetes, in some cases cure it, you know, there might be improvements in blood pressure and cholesterol levels over time, but it suggests that even if you're not in that morbidly obese group of patients, their BMIs, you know, greater than 40, the much lower levels of BMI, if you have diabetes, really, this is a potentially curative situation for you.
Well,
I'm excited.
I'll tell you quickly, Adam, I have a patient who had this surgery, is no longer on her medicines for blood pressure, for her diabetes, no longer on her sleep apnea machine. I mean, she is dramatically better in her health.
So we want you to work with your primary care doctor, New England Journal of Medicine, important research. It may matter to you and your loved ones. What about our very next research that matters, Christy?
Okay, how much do we sit in a day, Adam?
Well, Christy, I'm standing up right now,
yeah, right,
because I'm reading this research here and I'm like realizing that we sit while we're doing this show. But this was in the Archives of Internal Medicine about sitting leads to a shortened life. Not shortened like making you less tall, but shortened as in the things we care about.
Yeah, study done in Australia showing that people who spent more than 11 hours a day at a desk or in front of a TV were more likely to die of any cause during a 3-year period than the people who had more active lives.
220,000 people these researchers study. They get my kudos just for that amount in Australia. I probably need to go visit them to see what it's like. And they published this in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and they tracked this large number of people for 3 years, after which they discovered a little over 5,000 of them died, and to see to what extent this sitting really led to increased death compared to people who weren't sitting all that amount of time.
So the people sitting for at least 11 hours a day were 40% more likely to die during the study than the people who sat less than 4 hours a day. And it also had effects on cholesterol as well.
And it didn't really matter whether these people were normal weight or overweight. If they spent time working out and healthy or had other sicknesses, this sedentary lifestyle, long periods of time sitting, was really damaging. So what do we do with this, Christy?
I think the take-home message is really reflect on how much time you sit during the day and find ways to be more active. That can benefit all of us. Park a little further, use the stairs.
Start moving our arms and bodies right now, Christy, and our heads a little bit, even though our voices will go all over the place.
I want to try a stand-up meeting where we stand up and talk to each other.
And just kind of everyone's walking around and doing some exercise.
Might be distracting, but it's worth a try.
Worth a try. Well, that's some good research that matters. Let's listen to our very next one, though. It's about lung cancer, because this is something that affects really the number one cause of cancer and the number one cause of cancer deaths among men and women in here in North Carolina and around the country.
This was a study in the Journal of Clinical Oncology tying quality of life at diagnosis of lung cancer to survival.
And the Mayo Clinic, they followed over 2,400 patients for lung cancer over 11 years, and they looked at their quality of life at the time of diagnosis and then said, well, how does having low quality of life or higher quality of life as self-rated, does that have any link to improved or worsening survival?
So the people who had the lower scores, less than, if it's a scale of 1 to 100, if you rated your quality of life less than 50, those people survived for a remarkably less time, 1.6 years on average, compared with living 5.6 years in the group who had the higher quality of life around the time of diagnosis.
And we know that those who have poor quality of life are more likely to have some other differences, like current smokers, maybe more advanced cancer, men, unfortunately. But this also suggests that there are ways to potentially intervene or at the very earliest outset to ask patients about their quality of life, because this might actually be a way, maybe ultimately, we could help improve survival.
Yeah, it doesn't say for sure that improving that will improve survival, but it might. So more research for sure needs to be done, and we need to be asking our patients about this.
Absolutely. Speaking about asking our patients, this last research that matters, Christy, about insurance status and going to the emergency room is so important in light of what's happening now with the Obama Health Care Act in front of the Supreme Court.
This is a study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine looking at a large group of adults, 160,000 adults who responded to a national health survey, showing that people who either gained or lost their health insurance took more trips to the emergency room than those who had a stable insurance status.
And it really depended on how long you had the insurance. So if you had it, your health insurance for less than a year, a higher number ended up going to the emergency room compared to those who had it for more than a year. Similarly, if you had lost your insurance, more people went to the emergency room than those who had insurance. So this suggests that this having a stable source of insurance really does cause less utilization of emergency rooms.
And I mean, to me, this points towards access. People, if you changed your insurance, you might not know which doctor will accept your insurance yet. But if you need something, you go to the emergency room, you know they'll take care of you. And if you don't have insurance at all, then that's a safe place that you know you can go. So to me, this really speaks to being able to get into doctor's office and some of the transition that happens when you have a change in your insurance status.
Well, I'm real scared, Christy, because if the Obama health care law is ruled unconstitutional at the Supreme Court, 32 million Americans who would have had insurance will no longer will not have insurance, and this could perpetuate or even increase the emergency room as utilization, and that's expensive care, and it's not always the type of care we'd want for our relatives.
It's true. It's not as good for primary care needs, treating blood pressure and other things. You need to have an ongoing doctor for that type of care, although it is real good for when you do have an emergency.
I want your husband, Christy, if I have an emergency room, whatever emergency room I go to. Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Lola Reed about stem cell research. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about stem cell research with professor in the Department of Cell and Molecular Physiology at the UNC School of Medicine, Dr. Lola Reed. We are so glad to have Dr. Reed with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, welcome, Dr. Reed. Let's really just dive right in, first off, which is, what are stem cells and how did you become interested in it? Because you clearly are a national and international leader in understanding this research. How'd you get interested in what are stem cells?
I got interested because I was trying to figure out why we couldn't maintain any kind of tissue, a differentiated tissue, a tissue with specific functions outside of the body. And I worked through in the 1980s one facet of that, which is relationship between epithelia and another category of cells, mesenchymal cells. And that
so really two different types of cells.
Two different types of cells that are sort of like the husband-wife team, and they are partnered throughout the tissues, and that relationship is sacrosanct. But it wasn't enough in order to figure out about regeneration. And eventually I realized that the complementary story was that all the tissues are organized in lineages going from a stem cell to late stage, or if you want to call them geriatric cells. And that lineage, the cells are changing in their properties with every single lineage stage. So we began trying to figure it out for a tissue, in this case liver, and it took us a number of years to figure out how to identify them.
So let me just interrupt you just one second. So you're really talking about that these stem cells, are they in every organ system? Have stem cells, and is the same stem cell essentially reproduce and differentiate into these mature cells in the different organs?
The stem cells have two properties that have been utilized to define them for decades, and one is that they can make a daughter cell identical to themselves. We call that self-replication. The second is that they can make daughter cells of different fates, so that we call them multipotent. And so they can give rise to several different types of adult cells. And so those two properties are present in precursor populations in almost all tissues. There's still debate about some tissues, but it's certainly true for most tissues. And if you can figure out how to get them out, then those cells are capable of regenerating the tissue.
So what are the ways to get an adult or infant or these baby stem cells? What are the ways to capture them?
The cells can be identified by particular markers, proteins that are on the surface of the cells. And if you can find out what they are, then you can use an antibody and use it as a fishing rod to select out the cells that express that marker. And that's what all of us do, is we use a selection of those markers to identify the cells and to isolate them. The other way that we do it is by putting them under conditions in culture that only the stem cells can survive. And so we call that culture selecting.
So where do you get the stem cells from? Do you get them from living adults? Do you get them from the embryos that we know that there is some controversy? Are you now reproducing them just on their own from cell lines in the laboratory?
We get them out from tissues from cadavers. And so we spent some years organizing to get tissues that were either rejected from organ donation programs or from tissues from people who have died, and getting permission from the families to utilize those tissues. And the wonderful thing about the stem cells is that they last for hours and sometimes days after death. And so we are able to get them out and then process the tissue, isolate out those cells, and then we can regenerate that tissue outside of the body in various containers.
And so you're able to take those cells from a person who has passed away, if you're able to do it quickly, and then contain them, study them, and potentially grow them into new livers and pancreases. Yes. For other people?
Yes, and we're able to grow them out or even to utilize them in a person who has some condition that requires correction of their tissue, defects are. You can give relatively small numbers of the stem cells, and they will restore a lot of the functions of that tissue.
So tell us, let's give us a 2-minute tour. Where were we 10 to 15 years ago when it seemed as if stem cells were so controversial in society, not necessarily in medicine, but in religious and circles and conservative versus liberal? And then where we're at today. Help us understand where we were and where we're at today with stem cell research.
So what happened years ago was people thought that the stem cells only existed in an embryo. And there were some exceptions that we've known about forever. And those are the tissues that turn over very, very fast, like the intestine or the skin. And so the people who were studying those types of tissues have always known that there are stem cell populations, and there are many, many studies on them. Where they did not realize that in an adult person that there could be stem cells were the organ tissues, like liver and lung and pancreas. And those are ones that are now being recognized as also having stem cells. What everybody has realized is by knowing that they're there, it suddenly gives you ways of interpreting diseases that are going on, but it also gives you ways of treating the patient. And the third issue is that when people are exposed to various types of insults, the cells that can be vulnerable, that can be genetically altered to give rise to forms of cancers, are those stem cells. So the cancers are, in fact, transformed stem cells or early progenitors. And knowing that means that when you're trying to figure out what the distinctions are between a normal tissue and the cancer tissue, you really have to compare a normal stem cell with a cancer cell. So there are multiple fields that are benefiting from understanding about the stem cells and how they are playing a role in normal biology as well as in disease.
So in thinking about the using stem cells of adults or people who have passed away, that seems very different than this concept of creating life and discarding it that people were worried about with embryonic stem cells. What are the controversies with the use that you're talking about, using adult stem cell lines?
So when in the past, people thought they had only occurred in embryos, so that there were people working very hard to isolate stem cell populations from early embryos. And they isolate them from a particular stages of embryos, and those are called embryonic stem cell populations or cultures or lines. And those are the ones that have been at the heart of a lot of the controversies because of people's opinions and their religious convictions. The ones that are obtained from people postnatally, that is after people were born, have not been controversial. Those are ones in which we can isolate several types of stem cell populations, and they've all had usefulness. One category are ones called mesenchymal stem cells. that are from particular populations within the body. And those cells are already in many different forms of clinical trials treating people with various types of sometimes immunological disorders, or in some cases treating defects in bone or cartilage tissue. But the ones that have not been done so much are the ones from the epithelial category of cells, such as the lung epithelium or the hepatocytes in the liver or the pancreas. And those are ones that are just beginning to come online to go into clinical trials.
Well, we are looking forward to having a further conversation about the use and the hope that comes from this, especially with respect to liver and pancreas and other organs. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Lola Reed, about stem cell research. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Lola Reed about stem cell research. And Dr. Reed, right before we broke, you were starting to really tell us not only about multiple types of stem cell, but also kind of how this translates into the types of diseases that are being studied. Tell us a little bit about the types of diseases that are being studied with stem cells, and then we'll talk about your research.
I'm happy to do that. The stem cell populations that have been utilized the longest are the ones from the bone marrow. And these stem cells produce all the blood cells. They've been studied for decades and used for bone marrow transplants, for treatment of leukemia, many different conditions. More recently, there are ones being utilized for treatment of skin conditions. So burn patients are being treated with stem cell populations that are being grown up into sheets and then plated onto the skin and grafted onto the skin. A third category are the mesenchymal stem cells that are ones that are being utilized to treat patients with Crohn's disease or other types of autoimmunity problems or treatments of defects in cartilage and bone. But I'm going to focus particularly on organ-derived stem cells that can repair liver or lung or pancreas, because this is the latest wave of stem cell populations that are beginning to come online in the clinics.
Well, and it's very exciting because we know that there are so many people who have liver failure or who have problems with their pancreas and need organ transplants. But if there's a way to make a difference in, for people's lives using stem cells, that sounds like there's a lot of hope. I understand you're a pioneer in this area, huh?
My group and my associates and I have been working on it for almost 30 years.
Wow.
And so we are finally in the clinics now. And just finished about 5 years of clinical trials, and now hopefully are about to have an approved clinical product for some of those. And so in these, there are stem cell populations within the liver, and there are also ones in the ramifying ducts that connect the liver and the pancreas to the intestine. And that's called the biliary tree. And the biliary tree is actually like a root system, and it's filled with stem cell populations, very primitive ones, that can give rise to both liver and pancreas. And so in regenerative responses, those cells are responding and appear to be providing the stem cells actually that are within the liver, or in the case of the pancreas, they mature a little faster and they give rise to what are called committed progenitors in the pancreas.
Well, you know, let me ask you, because I know that as a clinician, we've known for a long time that you can live with only a small portion of your liver and that there is some regeneration that happens to the liver. This thought of stem cells in the pancreas or pancreas regeneration, that's something new, at least as to how I'm hearing it. And is there reason to believe that the pancreas then can, that we have some empiric evidence that is oncoming that chronic diseases that destroy the pancreas, you might be able to intervene with through stem cells?
Yes. It's very new. It's less than 2 years old. And there are groups of people in Florida, Italy, and in North Carolina, working together as teams to identify these. But these stem cells are not within the pancreas. They're in the biliary tree.
Wow.
Very near to the portion of the biliary tree that's very near to the duodenum, to the intestine. And those stem cells are in very high numbers. They respond to demands for regeneration for the pancreas.
Well, that itself is fascinating, that there's this little duct system in between the liver and the pancreas that has these cells that can go either way, that they can adapt and become pancreas cells or they can adapt and become liver cells. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct.
I just thinking about the human body, that's fascinating.
It is to us, too. We are just sort of stunned because we discovered it by accident. But we had found some years ago the stem cells that are within the liver, but now we found these that can go either way, either to liver or to pancreas. So the ones that we have characterized for the liver are the ones that are in clinical trials. And what we eventually worked out we can do is they thread a tube from the groin up to the liver, to the hepatic artery into the liver, and we just inject about 80 million of these stem cells. And the patient comes in the night before, they do this surgery that takes less than an hour, remove the tube, the catheter, and then send them home. And they don't have to immunosuppress the patient.
And their liver grows?
And they get restoration of a lot of liver functions. They don't necessarily cure them if they've got a virus like hepatitis C. You don't cure them, but you buy function, and the controls, the people who were just given standard of care, all died in less than a year. But those who were given the transplant are all still alive 4 years later and still with greatly improved liver functions. The one lesson they learned in doing the modifications, the tweaking to try to optimize this procedure is they couldn't give the stem cells too late. If the person was too near death, it didn't work, because it took time for the stem cells to mature enough to give the functions required by the patient.
And what type of diseases did these patients, what type of liver diseases did they have, or is it mixed?
They have various forms of fibrosis. They have cirrhosis. They had hepatitis B.
So advanced scarring of the liver.
Yes, thank you.
No. So, and I guess one of the questions would be, because this would be the sort of thing that, I've had relatives and friends that have died of pancreatic cancer and cancers, and you start to hear this and you start to think, oh, this is something I want. It sounds like, wonderful. And the first question would be, what do we know about the safety and risk of this? Can you talk to a little bit about what we know about that as far as its use either in liver or pancreas?
If you're using these cells that are found in adult tissues, the risks are extremely small. It's equivalent to bone marrow transplants. You will have the exceptionally rare circumstance where the donor happened to have a tumor cell mixed in with the stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
But that's extremely rare, and so there are markers now that we can try to use to rule that out.
And what about rejection, because this is not their own stem cells that are getting infused, right?
That is correct, and that's one of the great surprises of these clinical trials that have been going on for several years. We anticipated that we were going to have to worry about rejection, but it turns out that when we used the stem cells, we did not have to worry about that. If you use the older cells, the more mature cells, we had to use drugs that would correct for that rejection, just as if you were given a whole organ transplant. But the stem cells actually were able to generate tolerance. They were able to survive in the patient, and they've never had to be immunosuppressed, to our delight.
So thinking about the pancreas and the liver, I can see and I'm hearing that when you have scarring down from chronic pancreatitis or a pancreas problem that causes it to scar or a liver infection or problem that causes it to scar, that this makes a difference. And sounds remarkable, but how might this apply to someone who has cancer?
Okay, so I have to, the clinical trials that are going on right now are for liver diseases. We haven't done anything in clinical trials of pancreas.
Okay. I'm getting all excited because pancreatic cancer is such a scary diagnosis and thinking this really could be hope.
It could be, but it's so early. We're incredibly excited and trying to start figuring out where to start. And we're going to be starting with patients with diabetes. But indeed, the doors are open now to doing many different kinds of pancreatic diseases using the newly discovered stem cells that are in the biliary tree. And that's all going to happen in the relatively near future because we're able to get them out of that tissue and we don't even have to culture them. We can just give them back to a recipient very quickly, which means the likelihood of having problems is much lower.
Well, Dr. Reed, just one last final question. If we were to jump ahead 5 and 10 years, what is your hope and where do you think stem cell is going to move from the bench to the clinic and into the realm of regular treatment, or do you think we'll still be having this conversation because we will hit unexpected barriers? What do you think?
I think the stem cells that are what we call determined stem cells are going to be a normal part of a physician's repertoire of treatments for the patient, and that's going to happen within a relatively short period of time. I'm going to make a guess of 5 years. But there are going to be some diseases that are going to be more difficult, and that's going to still take more time. If a person's liver or their, I'm going to make a guess by conjecture, of the pancreas are so far gone, you still will probably have to have a whole organ transplant. But particularly for more moderate stages of the conditions, you're going to be able to treat first with the stem cell therapy.
So it might actually really reduce the number of people who get to that point of needing a full liver transplant. I mean, it's a remarkable
And that
discovery.
I know is going to happen, and happen pretty fast.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that hope, and more importantly, sharing your research and expertise with our listeners. It really makes a difference. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Lola Reed about stem cell research. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
And for all you listeners out there, we want you to send us your questions for an upcoming show to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And you could also, on our iPhone or Android app, you can just kind of press a button. It goes right to our email. You can also press a button. It goes right to our telephone numbers.
So many ways. The people who've written into us so far, we really, really are grateful for. We have good ones today about schizophrenia.
About asthma and allergies.
About rash and a medication called Lamictal.
And about something called fatty liver disease, a really important and underappreciated condition. So thank you. Let's listen to our very first house call about schizophrenia.
My sister has schizophrenia, and she goes through periods of time where her mental health gets better and then it gets worse. What causes patients with schizophrenia to get better and worse?
Well, I'm sorry to hear that about your sister and that there are these periods of time that she's continuing to have problems from the schizophrenia. It's so hard to understand exactly why people have the intermittent symptoms. They get better and then why they get worse again. It's really hard for us to understand.
Even more so, you know, why people get schizophrenia. I mean, it's such a tough disease because a lot of times it happens to people when they're in their teens or late teens or young adulthood, and they've had normal lives before then, and then they develop this.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about, schizophrenia is a mental illness where people can get hallucinations or delusions or disorganized thinking, all kinds of problems with thinking that can really affect
global functioning, hard to exist in the normal work period. On the other hand, they're really good medicines. And, you know, Christy, I know we really want to kind of answer this particular question about what causes it to get better or worse, which is like many mental health conditions. It just happens. And we don't fully know sometimes why something gets better or worse. Sometimes stress.
And maybe other aspects of a person's health. The
illness is right when they have other illnesses. And I know we want to do a whole show on schizophrenia, and we're going to try to get in touch with the nation's expert chairman of psychiatry up at Columbia to maybe really talk about this, because there's so many people. I've got friends of friends and family members and others. This affects pretty much, I bet, most families in one way or another.
I would agree. And I think there's a lot of hope that we will be able to communicate about compared new medicines and new therapies compared to how it used to be.
Right.
Good. Let's take our next house call question.
What is allergic asthma? My husband was recently diagnosed with this. I do not really understand what it means.
Allergic asthma. Well, you know, we don't typically always put those two words together. We talk about allergies, and with pollen out there that, you know, we recently had, that we can understand that. We talk about people who have asthma, and we know that these things go together, but when you put the two words together, interesting question.
It is. And the concept of allergies, asthma, and then some eczema or atopic dermatitis, a skin thing, often runs in families. And sometimes somebody unlucky might get all three conditions, but other times one person in the family might have allergies and someone else with asthma. But this is putting them together, of thinking of asthma that's attributed to allergies.
And there is some subset of people who have asthma who really the cause of their asthma are things like dust and mites and pollens and all kinds of things in their environment, some of which they could control, that trigger their asthma.
I was reading some data recently attributing 50% of asthma that is linked to allergies of some type. And so allergic asthma would just be that your husband falls into that category of having some wheezing and asthma, of asthma where the breathing tubes sort of constrict and get inflamed, that's related to allergies.
And a lot of the treatments we might normally do for allergies will help people with allergic asthma, like putting on those covers on the beds and having better filters, those HEPA filters, to really cut down on the dust in the environment. Obviously, no cigarette smoke around, but even some medications.
Absolutely. Some antihistamines or other medicines that can help. So it would be real important for your doctor, for your husband, to talk to his doctor about that.
Let's see if we can't get our friends at the Health Sciences Library to also put up a link about allergic asthma, because I think people are interested in this particular question. Let's listen to our very next house call question, Christy.
I have a rash all over my hands, and I'm worried it is because of a medicine called Lamictal that I recently started taking a month ago for my migraines. I don't want to stop taking the medicine, however, because it's working. But if the rash is from the drug, what else can I do? Help.
A rash from a medication, or linked in timing, it sounds like, to when you started taking this new medicine, Lamictal.
Yeah, and that's a pretty common medicine now that's used for a variety of health conditions. And it sounds like you've been using it for several weeks or a month pretty well. So the question is, to what extent is this rash due to that medicine? That's a good question, and not one that we maybe can fully answer, but we can give a few thoughts.
Well, I haven't heard that getting rash on your hands from this particular medicine is common. So we'll just put that out there. But it's always possible that you're having a less common reaction to the medication. And if the timing coincides, it might be worth exploring a trial off the medicine to tease that out. But it could be many other things.
Yes. One of the things we see commonly on people's hands is they get dry hands, and they get what's called eczema, or just dryness and itching and scratching. And if the rash isn't too bad, you certainly could just put some moisturizing cream on there, or some hydrocortisone cream on there, and try that first. Because if this medicine's working for your migraines, it's not a common medicine where I've seen a lot of reactions to. And 3 or 4 weeks into it, it's possible, but a little less likely than when you first started it. So common things first.
My advice would be just that, to use those common things, some Vaseline lotions. And if that's not working, you don't want to stop the drug. Go see your doctor, show the doctor the rash, and make a decision together about what to do next.
Good advice, Christy. Let's listen to our last house call.
I was told by my doctor after I had an ultrasound of my stomach that I have fatty liver disease, and that if I do not lose weight, I might develop liver failure in the future. He suggested weight loss surgery, as I've never been able to lose weight from diet and exercise alone. But what do you think? Would insurance pay for it? Would this help my liver?
Ooh, that's a scary diagnosis. I know. I don't know how it got that term, fatty liver. I guess under histology, Christy, they see increased numbers of fat cells that maybe cause kind of scarring and inflammation in the liver. Is that
It's true. They see it under the under a microscope, and it's also sometimes you see certain changes on an ultrasound and certainly on liver biopsy that have just more fat cells mixed in. It's related with being overweight for sure.
And, you know, when I was going to medical school in residency, Christy, I think I'd heard of this and maybe seen a case or two, but it was at that time, I was kind of under the impression that this was benign. Okay, you're overweight and you have fat in the subcutaneous tissue, the external, and you have some fat in the liver and don't worry so much about it. Yes, you should lose weight. But then I had a patient who had this who developed liver failure. And all of a sudden I was like, wow, this is actually real and a problem. And the only treatment that I know of for the fatty liver disease is weight loss.
It's true. And it's scary because most people go on and don't have any problems with it. But a small subset of people really can have true liver failure from it. So there
would insurance pay for it, do you think?
I think it might. I mean, I'd certainly call your insurance
and really push.
First.
You might need your doctor, your primary care, your liver doctor to really push for it. But it's something to consider.
There is data
weight loss
to support
surgery because, you know, we've talked about some recent research even today about weight loss surgery and diabetes. I bet on the forefront be weight loss surgery and fatty liver
there
disease.
There has been some data to support that it makes improvements on liver biopsy and improvements in developing that really terrible kind of liver disease. So I think it's worth pursuing.
Well, we've had a chance to talk about this fatty liver disease and possibly considering weight loss surgery.
About having a rash, the same timing of starting a medicine and how to sort that out.
About this allergic asthma, maybe some ways of treating it and understanding it better.
And a little bit about schizophrenia, and we look forward to having an expert on our show soon.
Well, thank you for joining us for Your Health. We hope that the issues we've addressed are important to you. You can send us questions and comments at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app.
And we want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Lola Reed. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
For Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We will look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.